And Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. So Judge Steike, District Court Judge, will be joining the court for ICE versus Department of Correctional Services. So, again, Mr. Heist, you're appearing by WebEx, is that correct? Are you with us here today?
Yes, I am here.
Good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Pardon me for just a second. Is it Mr. Strauss?
Hi, that's correct.
Very good. You are here with us in court today. And I think, Mr. Heist, you probably haven't noticed this, but court, one member of the court, Justice Miller Lerman, is also on WebEx today. And I just outlined the fact that Justice Frydenberg is recused and he has been replaced by Judge Steike, District Court Judge from Columbus, Nebraska. Judge Steike, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Judge Steike will be appearing or will be joining the court for all of the remaining cases. Mr. Heist, do you have any questions before we begin?
No, I believe I'm ready.
Very good. And Mr. Strauss, do you have any questions before we begin?
There you are.
That is also very good. So, Mr. Heist, you have 10 minutes and you may proceed. You may also ask to have a certain amount of time for rebuttal because it is possible that you can have rebuttal time after Mr. Strauss does his argument. Do you wish any rebuttal time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal time.
Very good. We will do that for you. So that gives you 8 minutes for your main argument, Mr. Heist, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. My name is Robert Heist, and I'm a pro se litigant or appellant in this case. I'd like to introduce my case in three parts, starting with jurisdiction, then textual interpretation, and then what I call inverted sentences and precedent. So first with jurisdiction, there are two jurisdictional arguments I make, one under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act and one under the Administrative Procedures Act. I'd like to point out to begin with that the UDJA jurisdiction is never challenged by the state. And that's because it can't be challenged. I'm actually claiming that there are official acts that exceed or abuse authority, and that is a justified claim under the UDJA. So I have jurisdiction under that. As far as the APA jurisdiction goes, there are two arguments against it the state makes. One is the Perriman precedent that you can't interpret statute, and two is the internal procedural document exception. So under the Perriman and Riley, its precedent standard, the current case is distinguished from that because the current case is requesting interpretation. Under
Mr. Heist, you're cutting out right at the moment, so we've got a little technology problem we're going to address here.
We should take off the clock.
Yeah. I'm requesting. Hello?
Now, Mr. Heist,
hello.
We've missed a couple minutes of your time here. If you can stop for just a second.
Court there. It says it's connecting up in the right hand. Hello, is the court back?
Absolutely.
It's jittery.
Nate, take your mask off.
Oh, apologize for that. I think
We lost his connection there.
Are you able to hear me? I think there's connection issue.
We can hear you now, but you're fading in and out. So, Nate, do you have any ideas? Is that our problem or is that their problem?
It's their internet.
I can't quite make out what you're saying. Okay, I can see video again.
Good, and we can see you right now.
Okay.
What I'm going to suggest
the audio
is, you have the audio?
Yes, the audio seems to have cleared out.
Okay, what I'm going to suggest is you go back to the beginning of your argument and start over, and we will start the clock over also. And I apologize for that. That's apparently part of the
technology. Okay. Tell me when you want me to start.
You may begin again.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I was saying, I have three parts: jurisdiction, textual interpretation, and inverted sentences and precedent. Under jurisdiction, I make two jurisdictional claims, one under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act and one under the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. The UDJA jurisdiction is never challenged by the state because claims under the UDJA are allowed to challenge officials' acts that exceed or abuse authority. So I have jurisdiction under the UDJA. As far as the APA jurisdiction, the state makes two objections. One is that Perriman bars from statutory interpretation, and two, that the internal procedural document exception qualifies applies to 104.08. So first on Perriman and Riley, which Perriman is based on, the current case is distinguished from both Perriman and Riley because I'm not asking for judicial interpretation of statute under the APA. I'm asking for judicial interpretation of statute under UDJA. Once my rights are declared under UDJA and the statute under the APA, that it be valid due to.
Mr. Heiss, can you hear us?
Ah, okay. Yes, you're back.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. The clock is at 8:40. We're giving you a little more time and.
Okay, yes. Shall I proceed? Again,
yes, you may proceed now. Yes.
Okay. So again, on the APA, I believe that we covered UDJ. On the APA, as I said, the current case is distinguished from Perriman and Riley because I'm not asking for judicial interpretation of statute under the APA, but under the UDJA instead. Asking for my rights to be clarified and statute to be interpreted. Then I'm asking for the rule to be ruled invalid under the APA for exceeding authority, statutory authority. As far as the internal procedural document exception goes, this doesn't hold water because Statute 83-4111 and 12 specifically direct NDCS to promulgate rules and regulations under the APA, delineating the inmate rights, and 83-4111-2D specifically states good time shall be declared under the APA rules and regulations. And 104.08 is the only rule or regulation governing 191 good time. Therefore, it must be governed by the APA. As far as textual interpretations, I want to first summarize the state's interpretation and then give mine, and then discuss imperi materia versus expressio unius. So the state's interpretation is basically, the good time is never applied to PEDs. It's only applied to TRDs. And this is because of a very narrow reading that they have of 83-1107-2C. And they say that just because of this one section, it only applies to TRDs. That's the section that calculates tentative release dates or jam dates. This is kind of like reading one chapter out of a book and saying you know who done it. This is not a complete reading of the full Treatment and Corrections Act. The appellant's interpretation is that the whole act has several sections. One section delineates different good times. One section tells you how to calculate TRDs, tentative release dates. Another calculates PRDs, PEDs. So these different sections must be read together in order to make a whole and to make them understandable. So for instance, the PED calculation in 83-1110 says that you calculate one half the minimum, and then it goes on to say as provided in, and it references back to the good times section in 83-1107. Neither good time nor TRD sections in 83-1107 are exclusive. They neither say min nor max when they define good time, and they don't say shall apply to max only when describing the TRD calculation. So the state's actually the ones that adding words. They're adding the word only and the word max to the definition of good time. Also, this court has repeatedly interpreted PED calculations to include good time, as they did in Adam v. The Board of Parole and Castillas and Caton. Yes, that was dicta, but it's so assumed that it's included, that it's part of the judgment. Now, as far as imperi materia versus expressio unis, this is how the state reaches their conclusion that you can only read very narrowly that one section. This is overcome by the U.S. case Marx, for the expressio unis can be overcome by indications. And this is pretty clearly indicated when the introduction of these LB 191 uses an example where they calculate a PED and decrease the time. So the very example used to introduce the bill applied to PEDs, to parole eligibilities. So the legislative intent clearly shows that it overcomes expressio unis. As far as imperi materia, does not require any additional words as the state's interpretation does. It doesn't create any conflict between sections, and it reads the rest of the Treatment and Corrections Act and the sentencing guidelines and other parts, the victim notification statutes, all in harmony. That's the way that you get harmony in the statute. The state also argues that there's a specific versus general, that you must always side with the specific. However, that's only if there is conflict between the specific and the general. And if you read them in peri materia, there is no conflict. You don't have to choose one or the other. Plus, both are specific in my interpretation. One specific calculation for TRDs is in 83-1107, and one is for PEDs is in 83-1110. So they are both specific. As far as inverted sentences and precedent goes, first let me define what I mean by inverted sentences. Simply put, that's when your maximum gets lowered below your minimum. So you end up having your TRD drop below your PED. You become eligible after you jam a number. This is illogical. So first off, the state never addresses this argument in their briefs because they can't argue with the math. And secondly, it's not just theoretical. This isn't just some math that I'm doing. It's actually documented that in 2019, there were 62 people incarcerated in NDCF who had inverted sentences because of 191 miscalculations. So the illogic of this inverted sentence situation is why the statutes are open to interpretation today. That illogic is the reason that you're able to actually view these, even though the state says that you can't observe these laws. So the final point is that the illogic of inverted sentences contradicts the logical reasoning behind the earlier cases that the precedent that this court made in Johnson in 2002, Castillas and Caton, where you decided that mandatory minimum calculations were exempt from good time. You use the same logic that inverted sentences could not be justified, couldn't have been the legislative intent and violate logic. So it's NDCS's interpretation that is in an incomplete reading of the Treatment Act and violates logic, legislative intent, and even judicial intent. When a judge gives you a max and a min, they intend you to have a max and a min and not end up inverted. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? I'm not seeing any questions. So thank you, Mr. Heist. Mr. Strauss, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Strauss, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state and represent the appellees in this case. The court does not have subject matter jurisdiction with respect to Mr. Heist's APA claim because policy 104.08, which is entitled Inmate Time Calculations and Sentencing, is not a rule or regulation as defined by the APA. And it's not subject to review because the state's limited waiver of sovereign immunity does not confer jurisdiction for declaratory relief concerning the judicial interpretation of the statute. Mr. Heist just argued that he is attempting to challenge the interpretation of the statute through the UDJA. And then once a result, it sounds like, is determined from that, use that as a groundwork for asserting his APA claim. But Your Honors, that's really putting the cart before the horse. It's an undisputed
I beg your pardon me, I have a question. Is there a vehicle by which the appellant could challenge the interpretation of LB 191?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is through the Uniform Declaratory Judgments Act, just not through the APA. It is an undisputed fact amongst both parties that the purpose of policy 104.08, which I'll refer to as the department's good time policy, the purpose is to outline the methodology to for calculating an inmate sentence pursuant to 1, Nebraska statutes, 2, the opinions of the Nebraska courts, and 3, the opinions of the attorney generals. Now, Mr. Heist referred to policy 104.08 being the only rule or regulation, in his words, to talk about good time. However, the promulgated rules and regulations from Nebraska's administrative code, Title 68, Chapter 1, specifically Section 2, is that promulgated rule and regulation as required by statute, which specifically says the department will apply good time to an inmate's sentence in accordance with Nebraska statutes, the opinions of the courts, and the opinions of the attorney generals.
Is there a statutory basis or some other authority distinguishing between rules and regulation and policy?
Your Honor, the APA specifically refers to what is not a rule or regulation, includes internal procedural or internal documents.
So your argument is this is an internal document?
Yes, Your Honor, it is an internal document. But even if it weren't considered being an internal document, it's still, Mr. Heist is still asking interpretation of a policy that is only interpreting statute, as opposed to creating its own independent standard, which would be available under the APA to challenge.
Counsel, if the department itself calls it an administrative regulation, how is an inmate to know whether it's a rule and regulation or an internal policy? How is somebody supposed to figure that out?
Sure, Your Honor. It does require a looking up through the administrative code what's been a promulgated rule and regulation.
Does the statute require that it be a promulgated rule or regulation? Or does the statute say any rule or regulation?
Your Honor, I apologize. I do not know the answer what the specific statute says. However, I will note that at least as of the past several years, the department has in fact changed the nomenclature AR administrative regulation to the broader term policy.
So do you get, does the department get to distinguish what's a policy and what's a rule? Determine governance, what, who gets access by way of the APA? Is that your argument?
Yeah, and I don't believe that it's the department's choice as to what policy or rule of regulation is challengeable under the APA. However, I think the court needs to look at the what the policy or rule of regulation is actually doing. And in this case,
pardon me, but it seems to me that you just suggested that change the nomenclature so it wouldn't be, the APA wouldn't be available.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, answering Justice Stacey's question, I was attempting to distinguish how an inmate can distinguish between what is a rule of regulation versus a policy, which is difficult to distinguish. The court has to, in fact, instead look at what is actually being, what the policy or regulation is actually creating, or whether it's creating a specific standard, or rather if it's just interpreting statute.
For a rule or regulation, there's a process that goes through the Attorney General's office, and then the governor signs off on it, and then it's filed in the Secretary of State's office, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in this particular document, whatever it may be, did not go through that process, did it?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
So from the department's perspective, it's not something that has the force or effect of law as we would accord a properly promulgated and adopted or regulation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Should it have gone through that process?
No, Your Honor, because again, this is not a policy that creates its own standard, which is what's defined in, as a rule of regulation in the APA. Rather, it's simply an internal procedural document to guide and outline the methodology for calculating sentences, again, pursuant to statute, pursuant to the good time laws. So
does it mirror the statutes regarding good time laws?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does it mirror the statute regarding good time laws?
Yes, Your Honor. The policy virtually is identical language to the various good time laws applicable to when a particular good time law was passed.
So the policy just merely says that you have to comply with rules or the statutes, the opinions of the Nebraska courts and the Attorney General. Is that the heart of the policy?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. If there are no further questions about the policy, I'd like to move on to the statutory interpretation of this good time law. So it's second.
When the time runs out, I'd like to talk about inverted sentences.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You agree that there are at least 62 as of 2019, 62 inverted sentences because of the interpretation of this good time statute. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What have we said about inverted sentences in our cases?
Your Honor, in the previous cases, when we talked about inverted sentencing, particularly going from the laws passed in 2003, the amendments in 2003, when we dealt with mandatory minimums, the court said that inverted sentencing does go against the, well, it should be the legislative intent to assure that an individual serve their mandatory minimum before they could be eligible for parole and not, in fact, have their mandatory discharge date before they're eligible for parole. However, what happened with LV 191, it's not just because of a specific sentencing scheme with mandatory minimums imposed by a judge that can potentially and infrequently cause inverted sentencing. Rather, it's based on a combination of several factors, such as, again, that specific statutory scheme, excuse me, sentencing scheme a judge imposes, as well as the individual inmate's behavior in prison, in which they can earn good time. The legislature, in attempting to account for inverted sentencing, cannot be expected to determine or foresee every consequence of a particular statute.
I beg your pardon. Is it a consequence of LB 191 and or policies combined that inverted sentences continue to be, quote, imposed?
Your Honor, it is a combination of the sentencing scheme as well as the potential for an inmate to earn additional good time applied towards their maximum discharge date. I'm not quite sure what you mean specific to policy.
Well, I think that's an answer to a different question. Are inverted sentences being pursued by the state?
Your Honor, I apologize, Your Honor. I believe I'm out of time. May I answer Justice Miller's question? Your Honor, they are not being pursued by the state. Once again, it's simply a function of the sentencing scheme. The state or NDCS does not go out and pursue to create inverted sentencing.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Perhaps pursued was the wrong word. Are inverted sentences being imposed, pursued, followed? You can help me out on the language. Do inverted sentences still exist?
Yes, Your Honor, it is possible that they can occur. However, the plain language of the statute does not let us even get to whether or not that result is, as Mr. Heiss stated, absurd or not.
That leads to my question then. Is it an absurd result to have inverted sentences, or is that just a byproduct of the statutory language created by the legislature, which, whether they intended to or not, was what happened?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it's simply a byproduct of it. In 2003, that was when the focus is to make sure inverted sentencing wants to happen. When LB 191 was passed, that was not mentioned at all about a concern. Like you, as you said, it's merely a byproduct.
It seems that this statute has morphed over the years. It used to be that good time applied to minimum sentences. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Up until 1995, good time credit actually specifically stated in the plain language that it would apply to a minimum sentence to determine parole eligibility. After the amendments in 95, it switched over to a different statutory provision, which talked about not good time credit, but rather just how a parole eligibility date is determined by having the minimum sentence.
Does that seem to be a clear intent by the legislature not to apply good time to the minimum sentence?
I believe it is, Your Honor, just by with respect to the plain language in 1,107(2)(c), which explicitly says that earned good time credit applies to the mandatory discharge, excuse me, the maximum sentence to determine when discharge is mandatory. With that, Your Honor, I apologize for going over time. We ask that the court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 2 minutes and 1 second, Mr. Heiss.
Thank you. So first off, on jurisdiction, I will again point out that though good time is covered in a single paragraph in the administrative rules and regulations that NDCS passes, it is generic and we will follow the statutes, and there is nothing specific governing 191 good time, and this is required by statute that they delineate good time rights, which they do not do. Also, they seem that, well, we cover it by having this one paragraph that states we do it according to the statutes, but they're not. It's actually their interpretation. 104.808 is their interpretation of statute. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had the debacle in 2015 of mandatory minimums being miscalculated. They interpret the statutes. It's their interpretation I'm challenging. Now, on inverted sentences, I'd like to point out that this was clearly the justification for even more recent cases since 2003, the Casillas and Caton cases, where the mandatory minimums were again at question. So if it was a behavioral reward to take off of your TRD, it should stand to reason that, and it was actually the example they used, that it should apply to your parole eligibility also. Finally, a note on the history of the statute. Yes, there was a time when it was changed, when it was changed to 83-1110 and separated, and it wasn't tied specifically to good time, but it still was variable based on good behavior. There were two clauses that were added in at that time that said that if they had alcohol or substance abuse or refused programming, that they couldn't be discharged. Eventually, those two clauses later, I don't remember the exact year, it was past 95, were removed, and it was then added the as provided in and tied back to the good time in 83-1107. So good PED calculations have always been variable for one, for good behavior one way or the other.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in Heist versus Department of Correctional Services. Mr. Heist, thank you for appearing by WebEx, and you are excused. And Mr. Strauss, you are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Newman. I am recused from this matter, and again, Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. And I'm also recused from State versus Strickland, and Justice Frydenberg is recused from State versus Strickland. So Judge Ott from Lancaster County will now join the court, and Judge Steinke, we've already introduced, he will also join the court for these last two cases. And Justice Castle, I believe, is going to be presiding, and he will explain more about that when I leave.